I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Victor Ullmann's final piece, Cornet, will be performed later this week on three nights in three different places. Joining me now is Catherine Loeb, who will tell us about Ullmann, this work, his legacy, and these upcoming performances. This year is the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and Elysium continues its mandate of producing music created by people persecuted by the Nazi regime. Cornet is the final work by Ullmann, who had been deported to Theresienstadt in 1942 and who was killed at Auschwitz in 1944. Catherine Loeb is a soprano who is the artistic director of the Second Sunday Concert Series at the Rohde House Museum here in Vancouver. She was also co-director of the Erato Ensemble from 2006 to 2013. She is a member of Callisto, the Vancouver Chamber Choir, and the Windsong Trio. Her website is at catherineloeb.com. The performances are at the Kulch on Friday, the 16th of October, Pyatt Hall at the VSO School of Music on Saturday, the 17th of October, and by invitation only at the Rohde House on the 18th of October. Tickets can be had at project-elysium.org. Please welcome to the Plant on Lead program, Catherine Loeb. Ms. Loeb, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Yourself?
Excellent. I'm well. Thank you.
So let's begin about Ullmann and his wife, Elizabeth. So they were brought to Theresienstadt from where?
They were brought from their home at that time. So people were coming to that particular camp from all over the German-speaking world. The camp itself was quite unique in that it was where the Germans intentionally concentrated this large population of Jewish artists, literary figures, and pretty much a lot of the sort of upper crust of society. So they put them there because they had a plan to sort of put them on display and then prove to the world that was coming through that what they were doing was still sort of within reasonable humanitarian standards. So the Red Cross even came in at one point, and they had this whole staged performance, and they would hand out cans of food on the day, so it looked like people were being well fed, and they'd take them away later, and they filmed performances, and they dressed people in proper clothes for the performances, but mm-hmm. didn't give them shoes. So if you go, for example, to there's an American Holocaust Museum. If you go to their website, they actually have clips of some of these propaganda films, all that survived the war. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that the shots are only from like the knees up, so they don't want you to see that there are no shoes on the people in the propaganda film.
Yeah, and so he Ullmann found himself there, and
yes.
And what was his career before that? I should say,
sure.
Had he composed a great deal of music beforehand?
He had a really interesting and diverse career before he found himself in the camp. He had done quite a bit of composing and had great acclaim for that. And he studied with his most notable teacher being Arnold Schoenberg.
Mm-hmm.
So he also was conducting. He was a radio personality like yourself, and he also did editing. He was a music critic, just all kinds of things. So he was a really kind of really diverse figure within the musical community, and he was having a really significant career before this happened. But the interesting thing is that before he went into the camp, he hadn't been doing much composing in that time because his life had been sort of taken over with other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then once he was in the camp, it paradoxically gave him more time to focus on this until he kind of came back to it at the end of his life, and it was one of his most prolific periods of composition while he was in Theresienstadt.
How do you explain this will to be creative when you're in a concentration camp like that?
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been doing quite a bit of reading on this subject, and Ullmann talks about it himself in an essay that he wrote on Goethe. And I'm not going to be able to give you a direct quotation, but something to the effect of, we didn't sit by the waters of Babylon and weep, but we basically they wanted to make something out of this time. So they were being, all these artists, these musicians, were being basically kicked out of European culture, saying all this work that you've devoted your life to, you're subhuman, you're not allowed here anymore. And for people like Ullmann, who were secular, he was a anthroposophist. So he wasn't a practicing, he wasn't practicing Judaism at the time, and he reconnected with that when he got into the camp. So to be told, okay, this whole culture, this community that you consider yourself a part of, you're not anymore, you're not allowed. It was sort of their act of protest in the camp to say, but we are here and we are a part of this community. We're a part of the wider European community, whether you accept us or not. So, people, when they're looking at their musical output from the camps, they'll say, well, why would they do something like Verdi's Requiem? And the answer is because that was a part of their adopted culture and it was just as important to them as it was to anybody else on the outside. Did I answer your question?
No, you did, yeah.
I could just sort of go on at length about that.
So when you hear the music, and as people will hear the music when they go to these performances this week, it's funny, you know, we're talking about music rather than listening to it, but
right.
if you could explain what it's like, what do you hear, say, when you listen to these pieces?
What a good question. Well, I definitely hear lots of his musical influences. So I hear that he studied with Schoenberg, so that he's exploring this sort of post-tonal soundscape. But then I hear also that he didn't choose to continue on that journey like Berg and Weber did and be really fully part of the sort of post-second Viennese school. So he's not writing 12-tone music. There's sort of a tonal framework for it, but when you look at his music, often there are no key signatures at all. And what he was exploring as a composer himself was coming up with his own new system for his own new sort of compositional and harmonic system based on some part of the overtone series. Mm-hmm. And you really do get a sense of that in his music. There are sometimes very wonderfully lyrical lines that anyone can follow and that really kind of speak to the average person on an emotional level, but then there's also this sense of an intelligence behind the music that's crafting a really interesting and thoughtful framework for all the music that's hanging on it. So you'll hear that he's going to sound like a composer that's coming out of the German tradition in the first part of the 20th century. So you'll hear some elements of post-romanticism. Occasionally, you'll hear some borrowing from popular idioms like jazz or cabaret. Hmm. He's just having explored quite a bit of his vocal music at this point myself.
Yeah.
I'm starting to get to know what his style sounds like, and he's very unafraid to tackle sort of more difficult musical elements like large leaps. But then he uses them intelligently, so there's a reason for them. There's always sort of a dramatic underpinning, and it just makes sense. It really works. And I think, I don't even want to think about what we lost and what he might have been doing 20 years down the road and how that might have influenced the rest of the sort of global classical music culture.
Do the pieces in that'll be performed at this event at Cornet, do they reflect his circumstances at the time that he's writing this music?
Very, very much so. So I think there's a certain element of longing that you'll hear in the piano sonata, which was written while he was in the camp, and then especially Cornet, this piece for piano and dramatic recitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a unique piece because there are other pieces for recitation with other instruments, but it's fairly uncommon. It's just such an interesting kind of musical and thought experiment that he does. It's quite successful. So the story is based on this kind of saga by Rilke about this young soldier who experiences basically a whole lifetime's worth of emotions in one night. So he's going through this process of falling in love and then reconciling himself to imminent death as a soldier. And so you hear all this drama in the spoken part, and then it's sort of like a melodrama almost, or like a silent film where you'd have the pianist playing as they're going in accompaniment. So the piano is giving you the emotional content and giving you the story and music as the words are being spoken over top.
Now, how did the music survive to Reichenstadt? I mean, because he'd been deported elsewhere, and then and obviously, well, I'll ask you, how did it survive?
You know what? A friend of his actually smuggled it out. His name is Alexander Vaulen. Mm-hmm. So when Ullmann knew, because there was this big sort of clean out of that particular ghetto in 1944 when the Germans sensed that the end of the war was imminent and they wanted to just kind of get rid of as much evidence as possible. And so there was this, I mean, it's horrible when you read the lists, all these bright lights in the musical pantheon all being shipped off in these couple of train transports to Auschwitz on October 15th in 1944. So he knew this was the end, because by then the machinery was becoming, the seams were showing, right? People, at first when the inmates wouldn't really know what that meant, by this time everybody knew what it meant when you were going on a transport, that you weren't coming back. And word had gotten back about the ovens and everything, so he knew what was going to happen when he and his wife and a lot of his colleagues in Theresienstadt were shipped off to Auschwitz. So he managed to give these manuscripts to his friend Alexander, who smuggled them out. And before he was in the camp, quite a few of his things had been published, but then, you know, banned when the Nazis came to power. And so there were some, I think there were some remnants from previous publications, but then there were just a few of these things that survived from the camps when his friend smuggled them out.
Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago about just what he would have done had he lived. I mean, just imagine what's been lost from, you know.
Yeah, it's you know, that in itself, that one bit of the story is so terrible to, right, to contemplate. And I think it's been my experience that sharing his story and sharing details like this really have an emotional impact on people and allow them an access into the larger story.
Exactly.
Because if we just, you know, if somebody comes and throws data at you about the number of people that died and the number of people that died on a certain day, or, you know, the percentage of the people that didn't survive even from Theresienstadt, which was one of the, it was like a display camp. It was like, you know, it was like a concentration camp light in some way.
Yeah.
We can hear that, but we can't take it in. Like, we're just not designed to take in horror on that scale, I think, as human beings, just to protect ourselves so that we can survive the terrible things we've done as a species. But being able to connect with one person's story in this way, I think, allows us to have some understanding of what the larger picture is and what the larger history means to us as human beings and in history and what comes next as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The significance of these dates, these performances around the 16th, 17th, and 18th, you mentioned that they were taken to Auschwitz on the 15th, so the 16th, 17th, 18th, I guess that was on purpose, was it?
Well, initially that's just how it worked out when I was discussing times of year that the artists could come over, because they have pretty busy performing schedules in the States and also abroad.
Uh-huh.
So we had a number of windows throughout the year that they were all three available, that I could bring them here. And then we just decided that October would be, you know, looking back from like a year and a half and 2 years ago to set this up, we decided that these would be good dates. And then I was looking at, well, what's the weekend? And then when I started putting together the website and really doing the reading, and I realized that one of these dates is actually when he arrived in Auschwitz and was immediately killed, it really just it hit me pretty hard.
Yeah.
That there's that element to it, as well as the fact that it's within the year that it's 70 years after the war ended. So there's been this sort of extra powerful energy behind the project for that reason and some others.
Yeah, it's one of those things when they say if there are any coincidences in life, and I kind of, you know, I kind of doubt it. Yeah,
definitely.
Tell us about the people. I mean, that'll be part of all of this. How do you pronounce it, guys? Michael Lahr? Is that how you pronounce it?
Sure. If you can say it that way, Michael Lahr.
Okay, and he provides the introductory lecture.
That's right.
And who does the dramatic recitations?
Gregory von Leitis. Mm-hmm. And I know why you wanted me to say that. Because every time I look at that name, I think, okay, how does he say that again? Okay, I have to think about it about four times, so I understand why you did that. That was very clever.
and so these folks, as you said, they're from abroad, are they?
Yes, they're both German.
And
they also have, sorry, go ahead.
And their connection to this, I mean, this is Ullmann's work is something that they've looked at a great deal or spent a lot of time with, I should say.
That's right. You've done your homework. Well done. So this is sort of their, I think, especially for Herr von Leitis, this is a big part of his mission in life, I believe. And I don't know that I'm going to be able to explain it properly, but I will try. So he's German,
uh-huh.
And he saw that there was all this art, all this beauty that was in the world that someone attempted to destroy, and someone from his country with the aid of some of his countrymen. And you can't go back and change things. They're what they are. They're unchangeable. But the way that I think of it is that he's performing sort of a musical rescue mission. That he's going back and they're going all over the place and researching this music and then performing it and having these lecture recitals so people can understand and have things put in context and, you know what they're seeing and hearing and experiencing. And so Elysium Between Two Continents is an organization that's based in New York and in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had this educational component of bringing American, young Americans who are sort of invested in the classical music system over to Germany and saying, well, this is what our tradition here looks like. This is how it's a little bit different. And here's what's beautiful and here's what you can take back with you for the rest of your lives. And then also doing concerts on both continents, which is the name of the organization, Between Two Continents. But then in terms of what they are doing as artists, they're having exhibits, so like documents and photographs that Michael often curates, and they'll go to universities and give these lecture recitals and so make this music available to people. And if you go and Google Victor Ullmann now,
mm-hmm.
There are lots of hits in lots of different places. His music is being recorded. It's being performed in festivals. It's being performed on standalone performances and recitals, both in the university setting and out of it. And this was not true 20 years ago when they started this work. And they're, to be fair, they're not the only people that are seeing the value of this music and really working to rescue it. But they really, they've been some of the most important and the most influential.
There are other performers as well. I mean, I guess you have a pianist and a vocalist. Is that correct?
No, actually, it's just
the spoke. Okay.
And the pianist. Yeah.
I see.
So the piece for I was talking about his vocal music earlier, so uh-huh. That might have been misleading. I didn't mean to do that. Sorry, I'll sweep up those breadcrumbs. So, yes, there's a piece for dramatic recitation and piano that's called Cornet. That's the title of the program and is the last piece on the program. Then before that, there is one of Ullmann's piano sonatas that Dan will play.
Uh-huh.
And then the beginning is a lecture. So the whole thing is just over an hour.
Yeah, and so I, in the research, I understand that you moved to Vancouver about 9 years ago. Is that correct?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. So what brought you here?
Oh, I get that question all the time. well, I married a Canadian.
I see.
That brought me here.
Yeah. Yeah. And it because I listed some of your accomplishments in the introduction, it is a quite vibrant art scene in this town, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And do you find as someone working in the creative class, if you will, that you're able to fulfill some of the things that you seek to do in terms of your career?
That's such an interesting question. So When I was in New York, I was really focused on this path of what is quote unquote the only legitimate way to have a career as a singer, which is to have regular work in the opera world, and that's sort of what you get trained through going through the system. But it became clear to me that that wasn't really my path. I didn't sort of fit in that box. And I struggled with that a bit when I came out to Vancouver. But then I started kind of finding my own way and making a path for myself. So for example, when I started Erato with William George, who's a tenor in town and composer, we started that because it was something that we wanted to see happen that wasn't already here. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of been my approach. And in Vancouver, it's a young enough town with an art scene that's still sort of growing instead of sort of having reached its peak and then plateauing and declining. There are still opportunities to create things and to have some interest. So like the Roadie House concert series, that was a potential and a need that I saw that could be filled for a particular type of music and a particular type of format. And so then I say, well, if you want something and it doesn't already exist, then do it yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I am. Vancouver, to get back to your actual question, I think in the long run, Vancouver has been really good for my career and my development as a human being. So I still do quite a lot of performing, but I also do a lot of composing work now, and I'm starting to work as a conductor, and then have also kind of surprisingly to myself found myself in this position of doing event concert production and not being involved at all as a performer.
Well, you've added a great deal to the community here from what I know of you, what I've read about you, and what I've heard about you.
Well, thank you for saying that.
And this event in particular is one that I'm sure will add a great deal to our knowledge, certainly, of Ullman and these events surrounding his life. And you're going to three different venues in the city. It's a wonderful example of showcasing these venues that we have in the city that I think we overlook sometimes.
You know what? I really appreciate that you said that. I really, really do. Because that's one of the questions that I've had for myself and that I've been asked in past, you know, why did you not just do it all at one venue? Because it certainly would have streamlined the process a lot to just do it at one venue. But thank you for saying that. That helps me have a different perspective and feel like there's a reason for me doing all that extra work.
Catherine, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for this. All the best.
Likewise, and to you.
The website's for more, CatherineLoeb.com. Project-Elysium.org for tickets. Do go onto that site. There's a lot of information there about Ullman, and there's a lot of reading, worthwhile reading on that site. Catherine Loeb joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.